Well, next hour, the secret history of magic. Make sure you're part of the program for that. When we come back with Dr. Jonathan Quick, author of The End of Epidemics, we will take your phone calls, your questions. If you've gone through the flu, why don't you share that story with us, too? And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Jonathan Quick. We'll get to your calls in just a second. Jonathan, how did you get involved in studying these pandemics?
Well, I've been working I'm a family physician by training and spent a couple of years practicing in Oklahoma after doing my residency, but taking care of gunshot wounds and snake bites and delivering babies. But I decided I like having whole countries as patients, so I've been working in Africa, Asia, Latin America, in countries to help them build strong, locally led health systems that can tackle the problems like AIDS, TB, malaria. But what got me interested in this was in the middle of the Ebola outbreak in 2013, and there was a lot of delay, and then everybody was kind of came in and was working on it. And I asked myself, where are things going to be in 3 years from now? I mean, mm-hmm. How do we get into this situation with an out of control epidemic and no vaccine, no medicine, and indecisiveness in different places? So I look back at the last 100 years of epidemics and said, okay, what can we do to be sure that this doesn't keep happening? Because we have this cycle of panic. Headlines, everything
else,
make promises, we're going to do this, that, the other thing. And you look back 3 years later, if you look, the first, it took 20 years to get going on AIDS. The first new human pathogen of the 21st century, something called SARS, that came out of China and knocked the economy of Asia horrifically. Lots of promises made. 3 years later, nothing. We had a avian flu in the 90s, same thing, lots of excitement, but then not much moved. So I really wanted to try to do something that would shake us out of this cycle of panic and complacency.
Is it like the boy who cried wolf sometimes, where they, you know, scream from the top of the mountains that it's the end and then nothing happens?
No, I think that's one of the things we need to understand is this is not an exact science. It's like weather prediction in a way, and you've got to get the right balance, because complacency kills as much as overreaction. So I think the key thing is that the people communicating need to be factual and neither hold back. And it's typical of governments to hide epidemics. China did that with this SARS outbreak I mentioned from there. It started in China. They hid it. Some of the governments in West Africa hid it for a while. So you want to get that right balance between alerting people and not either underreacting or overreacting. And we need to understand as a public that this isn't quite to where weather prediction is.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll start with our international line as we go to Ben in Doha, Qatar. Ben, welcome to the program, sir. Go ahead.
Hey, George. I just wanted to comment on the whole DOD thing you were talking about, the defense department.
Yes.
I think a lot of the reason that we've gotten out of that business and we have shut that down pretty much is it's unbelievably hard to control these viruses. So say we make one. How do we keep it from jumping into our troops?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And on top of that, we do keep a contingent around, but that's mostly like to see what works or to see what works, see what doesn't work, see the spread rates, calculate the spread rates, calculate, you know, basically the defenses against these bugs.
And Ben,
that's all I really wanted to say.
And let me ask you one quick question. You seem to know a lot about this. Are you in the military?
I was for about 10 years.
Okay. Well, thank you. I won't press you any more than that. We get calls from all over the planet, Jonathan, and that was from Qatar.
Yep. Good.
Now, he's got a point, though. So let's say they make these viruses, and then something really goes wrong. How can you, use them on, let's say, enemy troops, and then protect your own.
No, well, that's exactly that is probably the most important reason why there have not been more bioterror events.
You can't control it.
You can't control it. Now, but when you look at the different scenarios for something how smallpox so smallpox is probably the most horrific disease that humans have had. It kills as many as a third of the people infected and scars and blinds the rest. We lost 500 million people in the last century, and then we eradicated it. So that can be a bioterror weapon, because if the person who's managing it gets immunized and they haven't weaponized it past the point where the vaccine will work for the person, then they could. So that's why that's one of the most potential biological weapons is smallpox. But you're right. I mean, that's exactly the reason why there hasn't been more development of these new pathogens.
Do they always have the antidote available when they create a virus?
No, you can't. I mean, that's the point. You don't. The body's immunity is unpredictable. It's not like a crossword puzzle a puzzle game where you know what the shape of the piece is, and so you just cut it and put it in there. You can't know, and if we look at vaccine development, sometimes it goes really quickly, and sometimes with AIDS. It's intractable. We're still 40 years into the outbreak. More than that, we still don't have the vaccine. We're about 40 years.
Let's go to Oscar in San Diego, first time caller. Hey, hello, Oscar. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, hi, George. My question is this: every time I go to a doctor's visit, they always want to push the flu shot on me. So one time I confronted the doctor, said, "Why do I need a flu shot if I'm just here for a broken leg?" And he's like, "Well, you said precision we need to follow. Why do I want?" And I said, "Why do I want mercury inside my system, inside my body?" "Oh, that's not a problem. We can remove that." "So what else can you remove out of the vaccine?" "Oh, we can remove just anything you don't want in it. We got different ones." How does that work?
That's unusual. There was issues with some of the different preservatives and vaccines. And I'm a little bit perplexed by the answer you got, but the vaccines that are in use today have been well tested, and we've learned a lot about vaccine technology, and so that those sort of other ingredients that cause problems aren't there. And a couple of things about the flu vaccine, because number one, the flu vaccine will not give you the flu. Number two, it will not protect you against all of the different flus, because there are three or four flus. So it may protect you for some of the ones, but not all of them. But it will reduce your chance of dying if you do get the flu. And if it's 30% effective, from my point of view, given the potential consequences, I'll take a 30% reduction. To me, that's a no-brainer.
I had a doctor once, Jonathan, who came down with a syndrome after he got a flu shot. I can't remember the name of it. But
how long ago was that?
That maybe 20 years ago?
Yeah. So this was an interesting one.
Was it called Gears-Barre or something like that?
Did he have paralysis?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So that is something called Guillain-Barré.
That's it.
And
that's
basically, it is a post-flu thing that you get. So every year people get the flu, whether they've had vaccine or not. There's a certain percentage of people that get that. And it starts in your feet and works its way up. And the suspense is whether it gets to your diaphragm and troubles your breathing. But the key thing is that, indeed, back in the 70s, there was a worry about a swine flu. There was a vaccine which increased the chance a little bit of Guillain-Barré. Most of the people who got the vaccine and got Guillain-Barré would have gotten Guillain-Barré anyway, because certain percentage do. So, yes, but that was unique to that vaccine.
Why does the flu season seem to have a season? Well, why isn't it year-round? It seems to be more prevalent in the wintertime, for example.
Yeah, well, part of it is that the flu virus will hang around more, so it'll be more contagious at that time of year. And in the north and south seasons are follow a different synchrony. It's in the nature of the flu virus in our and the changes in the contagiousness.
East of the Rockies, Donna's with us, North Carolina. Hi, Donna. Go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Quick. A few months ago, when we were having very strained relations with North Korea, there was we got reports that there was groups of people that were being targeted and would become very sick, very disoriented, and they were thinking that it was from sound waves or micro sound waves or something. Do you remember that, George?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Quick, do you know anything about this, and what can that even be classified under?
That was in Cuba.
Yeah, well, it started. Well, yes, it was in Cuba, and that's where it started. But it's also been now those same phenomena in a couple of other places.
Yes, that's true.
That's not an area of expertise. So I've been tracking it, but I wouldn't want to opine on.
You
that.
Just wonder if somebody's bombarding them with something, some kind of technology, or they experimented on them. But it's weird, and I think most of our people that were stationed in Cuba did not get this in the embassy. That was erroneously reported. Most of them got it in their individual homes. It's almost as if they were sought out. People knew who they were, and they went right after them.
Yeah, very unsettling.
It really is.
I want at one point, I don't want to leave the vaccine question without just mentioning a couple of things.
All right, go ahead.
I mean, the before the measles vaccine came in, and the vaccine skepticism that we have now is in part coming out of a 20-year-old article that really launched the vaccine autism myth, and it's just been repeatedly proven that there's no relationship, and we can talk about how you decide whether event A causes result B. But the thing is, in this country, before we started measles vaccination, we had 500,000 cases a year of measles. We were down to 2,000 cases of measles. In the year 2000, we'd about eliminated it. And this resurgence of the vaccine autism myth has got measles back up here. And in Europe, where the same myth is getting propagated, they had 20,000 cases last year. But the reality is that since 2000, we've saved 23 million childhood deaths through immunization worldwide. And so I think we need to be really clear that when we look at thousands or millions of people, vaccines work, and they've been hugely effective in increasing life expectancy. And we're on the verge of eradicating polio, which would be just stunning.
What is the hot button these days, Jonathan? What could happen over the next year or two disease-wise?
Well, there are basically, four things that could really get us in terms of categories. One, it would be this flu. It's been a while since we've had a really big one, so that's definitely a possibility. We're tracking a few different viruses that are like this virus that came out of China, which could go global. I think the odds of a biological attack are low, but still there. But there's a last category, which is what WHO calls disease X. Sounds like a Madison Avenue term.
It does.
But so this is basically every year the World Health Organization looks at what are the threats out there and says, okay, here's the list of things we need to develop vaccines for. They added this year this disease X, and it basically refers to a disease that we've never seen before. We have to be ready to identify something new. And if you think about it, AIDS was the disease X in 1981 because it had never been seen before, and we were blindsided, and it got farther faster, and we have a bigger epidemic than if we'd been able to move quickly. Ebola was a disease X in 1976. It hadn't been seen before. SARS in 2003, and the Zika virus, which is devastating women in Latin America because of the birth defects, the small brains and a cascade of birth defects. That virus has been around 70 years, but it's a totally different in Africa, quietly, not causing any problem. Migrated east, landed in Brazil, got into the mosquito population, all of a sudden, poof. And it was really a very different disease. So the answer to your question, George, is the three above plus one that we probably don't even know yet.
It'll when we least expect it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who would have predicted if you'd asked the medical community to predict what was going to hit Latin America? In 2015, nobody would have described the Zika virus.
No.
You know, mosquito-borne, urban mosquito, different mosquito than the malaria mosquito, and these horrific birth defects, that also causes Guillain-Barré.
What is worse, mosquito-borne or airborne by contaminants?
Airborne. Airborne.
That's the worst.
Yeah, that's the worst because...
get it on planes, everything.
Planes and everything else. Without doubt. That's one of the few reasons why the flu virus, which is airborne, SARS, which is airborne, kind of a cousin of that, something called the Mediterranean respiratory syndrome, MERS, those respiratory ones are the big problem.
If you have the flu, and you sneeze on someone, and, you know, they inhale it, what are the odds of them coming down with the flu?
The simple answer is that's a whole lot more than if you'd have sneezed properly in your sleeve. and I think that's the point. I actually don't know that number. But the key thing is...
Even with resistance, you could probably come down with the flu, right?
Yes. And the key thing is that these things, hand washing is effective. Protecting your sneezes, not with your hands, but in your sleeve or something, or the washing your hands. And staying out of work, some years, those are more effective than the flu vaccine.
CDC said 2 weeks ago, Jonathan, that proper hand washing must last at least 20 seconds.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
That's two verses of Happy Birthday. And
just don't sing it at the sink.
Yeah, right. But it's also not just rubbing your palms back and forth together. It's actually curling your fingers around, getting... Both sides of your hands and really rubbing in on your fingers.
And under the nails, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment with Dr. Jonathan Quick, and we're going to take final phone calls. His book is called The End of Epidemics, The Looming Threat to Humanity, and How to Stop It. And we are back with our final segment with Dr. Jonathan Quick, author of The End of Epidemics. And, Jonathan, we'd love to use you as a resource. God forbid anything happens epidemic-wise, to get you back on the program. Would you be available for us?
Oh, yes. And yeah, absolutely. And you'd ask me what got me into this.
Yeah.
And one other thing on that, and that is I've got three daughters who are starting to get married and have grandchildren. And I know our generation, right, is leaving their generation. Our world is going to be much more difficult to manage because we've been overusing fossil fuels and melting the Arctic and all of that. I don't want to leave them a world that's also more dangerous.
I don't blame
infectious
you.
Diseases. And we know what the threats are, the sort of known and the unknowns, but we know what we need to be doing to build the defenses, but we're not moving quick enough. And it's actually... The cost of making the world substantially safer is about $7.5 billion a year for the next 20 years. That's like a dollar per person per year. Spent it at all the different levels on in a key way. And along the way, we're going to have these different outbreaks. But I think people need to get educated. There's some great films. The film Contagion. Do you remember the film Contagion?
I sure do.
So that film has a great scientific team that actually made it as realistic as possible. And the sort of breakdown in society that happened that's real. And there are a couple of pictures there that are parallels of iconic pictures. And they went as far in making this movie as to get a doctor to coach Gwyneth Paltrow before she died on how to have a seizure, so that it was all realistic. So I would really get people to look at Contagion because it is made to give a picture of what really could happen. There's also a good CNN documentary, Unseen Enemy, and the Smithsonian Institute in Washington has a great exhibit, Outbreak, that'll really give you a sense of it.
And by the way, my producer said, please emphasize that Gwyneth died in the movie, not in real life.
Yes, in the movie.
So a lot of people will send me emails going, oh, my God.
No.
She's probably listening right now going, oh, no, what happened to me?
No. But the point is it really was purposely made to be, yes, gripping, but also to tell a real story, a realistic story of what could happen if we don't take the necessary steps.
Let's go to Robert in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Robert, go ahead, sir.
Great show, like usual, and keep it up. Quick question for you, George, and a couple of questions, comments for the guests. When I hear these topics, I think of Dr. Leonard Horowitz, who was a big guest. What happened?
Yes, he's still on the list, just waiting for him to come up with some new material for us.
Well, get him back. He was just always interesting. Well, George, you don't get the flu, and a lot of people don't, and I appreciate you sharing that. My thing is, and I don't want to be disrespectful at all to anyone. I think the doctor, you sound like a great, educated person, but I never hear anything from MDs on natural cures, and there's just so much. I mean, there's literally 200 things that can eradicate a flu, and, of course, medical science, Western science, does not acknowledge these, and the issue I have is that there's really not much in terms of antivirals, aside from a lot of these vaccines and some really rough antiviral meds, but there's just a lot of natural stuff. You've had a lot of guests from Joel Wallach and
Ben Fuchs and all these people.
Ben and just so many people. Alex Jones has some, and I know it's controversial. I just wish the doctor would And other doctors, not necessarily, would educate themselves on what's out there, because they're really good, well-intentioned doctors. They're trying to do the best that they can. But, hey, if they don't know, how can they expect us? How can we expect them to teach us? And so they're not educated in this. You know, one quick thing here, antiviral, coconut oil, rich in lauric acid, antiviral, non-toxic, good for thyroid disorders. A lot of research on that. There's even potent extracts. I mean, there's literally 200 things, and I think it's really a disservice. And I'm trying to get away from the politics, because I'm like you, George. We just want to stay happy and healthy, and people to leave us alone. If there's a natural solution out there that's going to do it for pennies, and these doctors have taken the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm, then they're really failing us.
All right, well, let's get Jonathan's views on some of that. You know, Doctor, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I spent 10 years at the World Health Organization in Geneva, responsible for the pharmaceuticals department, and one of my team leaders was a woman named Zhaori Zhang, who was a joint-trained Western and traditional medicine-trained person from China, and we actually did support. She handled complementary medicine. And so I would agree that there are a number of traditional treatments that are very effective and are well studied. The thing that we need to be cautious about is the extent to which their safety has been checked. So you can pretty much tell whether you think something's working or not. What you can't tell is whether or not it is slowly eating away at one or another organ. And so there's one particular product that's common that you can get on 13 different websites. It's Aristolochia and variations of that. But that causes kidney cancer. And in countries where they're using that, they're seeing a big increase in kidney cancers, and it also causes kidney failure. So that is where there are very few traditional medicines. There are some, and we've looked at the literature. There's some where they've actually been regularly following it, and no, but that would be my one caution. And I agree with the caller that there are lots of things where alternative methods are better. And I personally believe that if you can take care of something with exercise, good diet, and a good night's sleep, I'd much rather have that than medicine.
Sure, and supplementation. I think that's critical, John.
Yeah, but I look really carefully and dig down and learn how to get in to see how they've studied the safety of it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Folks, for a lot of people who want that kind of information, you can go to criticalhealthnews.com as well. Where do we get the book, The End of Epidemics, Jonathan?
Well, certainly Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's available in hardcover and in e-books, Kindles and all. I like the Kindle because the infographics are in color. But yeah, that's the best way to get it. And some of the big stores have it. So either way, it's available, as they say, where books are sold.
We're going to Les out there in California. Welcome to the program, Les. Go ahead, sir. Les is more. Les is gone. Let's go to Pete in Palisade, Minnesota, though, east of the Rockies. Hey, Pete, go ahead.
Good evening. How are you doing tonight, gentlemen?
Good. Thanks.
Good. I was once diagnosed with the flu, and I had it real bad, and I was given an anti-inflammatory, and I didn't take too many of those and some cough medicine, but I had the body aches, the sweats, real weak, and nausea, you know, real bad. So I was diagnosed with the flu. But one thing that helped me, I was barely able to get out of bed, but I had some red sockeye salmon in the cupboard, and I was able to keep down bites of that, and it really like brought me around. And then I had some chicken broth with garlic mixed in.
Oh, that'll do it for you.
And then I heard that the sulfur in garlic, it contains sulfur, and that helps to bolster your immune system. And I also remember from college something about food grade iodine. They can use it to stain like a virus so that your immune system recognizes it and can zero in on it. Is there anything to these things?
I think the salmon is a great idea. And garlic does have some interesting properties and can be helpful. The iodine, I can't imagine any way that would you don't stain viruses.
And chicken broth is good. Mom made it for us when we were sick.
Yeah.
Let's go next to Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Hello, Frank. Go ahead.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you.
Thank you, sir.
I want to make a couple comments. I'm 70 years old. I never had the flu, and I never had a flu shot. Now, I'm either extremely lucky, have God's grace, or I'm living right. Now, on the Russian thing, why would Russia use a chemical weapon on a double agent and have it traced back to them? They've got at least 100 other ways of doing away with somebody without trace. And then this thing with chemical weapons, any potential adversary has got to know that the United States hasn't destroyed all of their chemical weapons. Who can deliver it better than we can? And we might even have some hidden away in a potential adversary's country. And then one other thing, the thing with Oswald and the Kennedy assassination, why use a weapon that can be traced back to you so easily?
Well, that was a plant, I think. But that's a different show and a different story, to be sure. As a matter of fact, I'll be talking about JFK tomorrow night with Mike Barra. So make sure you put that on your calendar.
So let me make a comment.
Go ahead, John.
Because I've talked a lot. I've heard a number of stories of people who haven't gotten the flu, and like Frank and yourself. When I gave a talk in St. Louis, and with a cab driver going out for the talk, we got talking, and he was in exactly the same situation, but somebody talked him into getting a flu shot, and then he got the flu. So I talked with him, and he assumed the shot had given it to him, which I knew that hadn't given it to him, but I wanted to know what it was. Well, it turns out he went to a hospital that had lots of people in the waiting room, a fair number of whom probably had the flu.
Oh,
and it
gosh.
Turned out he was just as susceptible
sure.
as anyone else, but he hadn't been around it. And this is one of the things, I mean, part of planning for flu season, you know, we had hospitals out west that actually put up a tent in the parking lot because they had too many people. So one of the things is actually... with Ebola, we turned hospitals into transmission centers for the disease because everybody flocked there. We do that sometimes with flu. So I think that we just need to be thoughtful about the reality that we don't all need to go in and can do some home testing and manage our learn to manage our flu ourselves as long as I would still say getting the flu vaccine.
We take text and tweets. Tom's got one for you, Doc. Go ahead.
Yeah, this one's from Rocco in Fort Myers, Florida. Is there one thing the doctor recommends people taking at the very first signs they feel they might be getting the flu?
What do you think of that, John?
Well, I definitely keep on fluids, and antivirals that are on the market, that if you take them early, they will shorten it by a day or so. And the Japanese have just registered one that is purportedly a whole lot more effective. But aside from that, no. I mean, I'd stay hydrated and treat the symptoms. And the most important thing is to not spread it to other people.
We go to Bruce in Woodland Hills, California now. Let's squeeze you in, Bruce. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you for taking the call. I've got two questions. One of them is, what are the ingredients, and this is in regard to the vaccines, and even it can relate to the flu shots too. What are the ingredients in there? Are they posted where people can read them before they take them and understand what's being put in their body?
Yes. There's an extensive legally required package insert that will tell you what is in there, and we'll give you all of the information about the known information about the risk, the side effects, the people who should be careful about it, whether there are anything in there that is likely allergen, and so that it's called a package insert. You should normally get some information, but you can always ask the pharmacist for the full scoop on that.
And let's get your other question in real fast, Bruce. Go ahead.
If these flu shots prevent illness and sickness, what would be the pharmaceutical company's motivation, since their sole business is based on sickness and not cure, and an ongoing disease and managing disease, rather than people getting themselves healthy?
Oh, well, I mean, but selling a vaccine, you make money selling a vaccine.
Lots of money.
Yeah, no, it's a big market, so they'll go. I mean, the thing is, for the people making the vaccine, it's other people losing the business of drugs if the person got sick. But the problem is, one of the reasons I believe that we don't have a more effective flu vaccine is because the cost of switching over into and doing the research to get a universal one and to get one that we can make quicker, that's a cost that they don't want to pay. So I do think that that the economic dynamic there is getting in the way of getting a really effective flu vaccine.
Jonathan, thank you. And again, and we'd love to keep you as a resource, so we'll be tapping into you every once in a while. And God forbid, if there is a pandemic, we'll get you back on. Up next, the secret history of magic.